Genesis 11, it's a story about the Tower of Babel, that they can do anything. What would have happened if God would not have intervened?
It's a good question. Basically, in the story of the Tower of Babel, why did God object to the humans building a tower that would rise up to heaven and that there would be nothing impossible for them? Essentially, although this may mix stories, essentially I see this as the same issue as to why Adam and Eve were sent out of the Garden of Eden. They were sent out of the Garden of Eden so they would not eat of the fruit of the tree of life and live forever in their fallen state. If they had, they would simply be forever condemned, and there would be no place for God's mercy for them. They had already disobeyed by eating of the forbidden fruit. They had not been forbidden to eat of the fruit of the tree of life. But they did not do so after they had, eaten of the forbidden fruit. So if God's mercy is going to be available to people, then they cannot achieve it themselves. And you see, in the case of the building of the Tower of Babel, this was an attempt by man to reach up to heaven and to achieve godhood, or achieve a relationship with God, if you want, by reaching up and taking hold of God. It doesn't work. We don't come to any kind of an experience of God by our own efforts. And in the Christian perspective, we do not achieve salvation. We receive salvation by the grace of God. And the idea that the people in building the Tower of Babel had was to achieve by their own efforts what it was actually impossible to achieve. Because heaven is not actually up there. I know we think of it and we picture it up there, but we all know that through the space program, people have gone way up there and they still didn't find heaven. Heaven is not up there. Heaven is a place, but a spiritual place. And it will not be reached simply by building a tower. The people were saying, let's get to heaven by building a tower. But you can't get to heaven by building a tower. You can only get to heaven by the grace of God. And this is so in the Old Testament as well as the New. And the confusion of the languages simply broke up this idea that you could get to heaven by doing some kind of cooperative project, everybody together. You can't do it. And even if they were to cooperate together and to build the tower all the way up there, they still, while they might achieve many, many things, they still would never achieve the goal of connecting with God, because you can't do it. Now, if, as modern researchers believe, the tower was actually an ancient ziggurat, of which they have found at least one very large example in territory of Iraq, as we call it today, or ancient Mesopotamia. If that's what the tower was, then the whole purpose of the ziggurat was for some kind of religious purpose. And so they were building the tower to take them up to achieve a religious purpose that you just cannot achieve. And the breaking up of the languages was done simply to, you might say, terminate this effort, so that instead of trying to reach up and grab hold of God, people had to go in other ways, ultimately to the grace of God, to be able to find God. Not only was confusing the languages an act of mercy, have you ever had a situation occur in your life where at the time it seemed like a really difficult thing to happen, and maybe you even prayed, "No, God, not this." But later on, you look back and you see that it actually was an act of God's mercy that brought you into something far better than you could ever have imagined or hoped for at the time you were going through that situation. Well, I see the event in the Tower of Babel in this kind of a mode, that God intervened in order for them to have something better than what they were trying to achieve by their own efforts. And the Tower of Babel, I think, is a story that shows that. And actually, in terms of Old Testament theology and interpretation, generally there's not much said about the Tower of Babel. And actually, there's only a limited amount that's even said about Noah and the flood. There's a lot about creation, and then you start with Abraham. But I think that the Tower of Babel is an important illustration of the mercy of God at work in early human history, before you have any kind of development like a promise of God to Abraham, or a choice of the Israelites, or the promise of a Messiah, or the coming of Jesus, or any of these later things. You see the mercy of God. We talked about the mercy of God just a little bit yesterday. You see the mercy of God at work across humanity in the story of the Tower of Babel. The intention being that by what God did, they would have much more than if they had been successful in completing that tower. And so out of that came the multiple languages that are spoken today. The idea of the power of unity, again, it really doesn't figure much into Old Testament theology, although I think it's a very important concept, the power of unity is very great. And so I'm going to diverge for a minute into sort of a pet peeve of mine about Christianity today. And that is the area of prayer. In the New Testament, Jesus says, where two agree as touching anything, it shall be done for them by my Father who is in heaven. You know that verse? Okay. Now, in America today, when people want God to do something, they gather large numbers of people, as large a group as they can, and ask them all to pray to God to do something. And if God doesn't seem to do it, they try to get more people praying. And more people praying. And I've even heard some people, they're not pastors, but they are serious, committed church members who say, we're going to storm the gates of heaven in prayer that God will do thus and so. What does the Bible say? That storming the gates of heaven is going to convince God to do something he does not want to do? In the Old Testament and the New Testament period, if you storm the gates of a city, you were the enemy. You were not the friend. Number one. Number two, why do we think that if 100 people praying doesn't convince God to do something, that 1,000 people praying will convince God to do something? God is not a human like us. Now, in the world we live in, if you go to a politician and there's 100 of you, the politician may not listen to you. But if 1,000 people go, maybe the politician will listen. If 10,000 people go, maybe the politician will listen faster. If 100,000 people or 1,000,000 people go, maybe the politician will listen faster. God is not a politician. And God is not seeking your vote to stay in the office of God. God is above all that, and God has His way. And if you want something done by the Father in heaven, Jesus has told us exactly what is required. Two hearts praying as one. That's the united. Two hearts praying as one will move the Father to do something. 200,000 hearts praying will not necessarily move anything, because that is not the way it works. I will tell you, a lot of people in the United States that have heard me say that kind of squirm, and they don't like me. And some of you may be squirming and don't like me now either. But remember that. Jesus has told us, two who pray as one, touching anything, that will be done by the Father in heaven. You don't need an army of what they call in America prayer warriors for something to happen. Now, it's fine if you have 200 people all praying as one, because you have 200 people that will not only be rejoicing when it happens, but 200 people who will probably be very involved in whatever the result is. but for, you might say, moving the hand of God, you only need two, praying as one. And that's it. And unity is very important. But you have to understand how unity is important. And unity is not what you might call political unity. Unity is unity of the heart. You actually mean the same thing. You may not even say the same words, but you, in your hearts, in your minds, if you want, in your kidneys, you believe and are asking for the same thing. And it can be across continents. It can be halfway around the world. But you are asking for the same thing as one. So yes, unity is very important. And whether it's in the positive sense or the negative sense, unity is very important. But I think it's important to realize that in terms of prayer, God is not moved by hundreds and thousands of people praying if that is not consistent with God's will. And I mean, this is just the reality. God is not like us. As I've said to them, God is not an American. And God is not a businessman in the sense that we think of it. Because these are all business techniques and political techniques. But they're not biblical. Let's talk more about human relationships. We started by talking about the relationship to God and the fact that we live in two worlds. This world, the created world, and the spiritual world. We don't see it, and because we don't see it, we don't recognize it. There's a really interesting story in the Old Testament where I think it was Elisha was, he asked God to open the eyes of his servant, and there was an invading army, and the Israelites were very, very upset and very concerned about what they were seeing. And Elisha wasn't worried at all. And the servant was just really distraught and upset. And Elisha said to God, open his eyes so he can see. Like that, the servant looked. And he said, why, the number of them that is with us is greater than the number of them that is against us. Do you remember that story, anybody? Yeah. You see, there was a world that he could not see. Elisha saw it with the eyes of faith. And when the servant's eyes were opened, he actually saw it. Elisha wasn't worried because he knew God was going to deliver the people from the hand of this enemy. Well, this is the thing. There is a spiritual world around us. I like in the New Testament, Jesus didn't say that you find the kingdom of heaven out here somewhere or there somewhere. He said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. He was talking to Jewish people, by the way, who only had the Old Testament when he said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. And so many times we have the idea of thinking out here somewhere. But we have the New Testament that tells us the kingdom of heaven is within. And again, we live in both the physical and the spiritual dimension. Well, to go on. Vocation and purpose is another part of our relationship to God. And we've already talked about the fact that humans are to exercise divinely given stewardship over creation. In other words, we are to take care of creation. When God created man, he told Adam essentially to be the gardener, to take care of the garden. And this is what we have been given, whatever our garden is. Our garden may be the people around us. It could be the job that we have. It could be the responsibilities that we have to friends, and it can be responsibilities to family or responsibilities to other people, or there's all kinds of different possible interpretations of the garden. But whatever the interpretation of the garden is, we have been given a responsibility to care. Humans have been given a responsibility to take care of the creation that God has created on behalf of God. That is our vocational responsibility according to the Old Testament. This means not exploiting it for self-interest, but faithfully and even lovingly tending it and helping it to achieve all that it can be. Take for example, at the human-to-human realm, if you have a supervisor or a coach, and the coach works diligently with you to become more than you are and to achieve a high achievement, what do you think of that coach? You hold the coach in very high regard. If the coach is using you for his or her own purposes, or if the boss is using you as a way of stepping up personally to a higher position in the company or the organization, then what do you think of the boss? You see, the stewardship involves taking care of those that have been committed to your care. Not exploiting them, but taking care of them, tending to them, helping them to achieve what they were intended to achieve. And that's what a gardener does. Whether it's a gardener of flowers, a gardener of vegetables, a gardener of fruits, or whatever it is, the gardener is trying to help the plants to achieve a high measure of fruitfulness. And this is the responsibility that humans have on behalf of God with the created order. Now, fundamentally, to do this requires a relationship with God, because if you don't have a relationship with God, you might not, in fact, almost certainly will not, achieve the divine purpose that God has for you, and may fall into a dehumanizing situation instead. And so the relationship with God is essentially necessary to be successful in tending that part of the garden that that has been given. And this was part of the passage in Deuteronomy 6, where God is supreme, and one only finds true being and selfhood through the relationship with God. And so you see in Deuteronomy what's known in the Jewish world as the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one, the Lord your God, Yahweh Elohim, is one. A statement against the polytheism of the other peoples. And he is uniquely one. There is no other one like him. And you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength. You remember it? And what's the other part? You will love your neighbor as yourself. And this is the Old Testament, you might say, statement concerning what the human relationship to God should be. You will love the Lord your God with your heart, your mind, your soul, your strength, and you will love your neighbor as yourself. And it's important not to refer to it as the first and second commandment. That's how the Jewish world did in the New Testament. But loving the Lord your God and loving your neighbor as yourself are part of the one action of a relationship with God based on the Old Testament. Okay, now another area is the supernatural realm. The supernatural world was simply assumed in the Old Testament and the Old Testament period. There is no attempt to say where it came from. There is no attempt to justify its existence or to get rid of it or anything else. In the Old Testament, there were demons. There was the adversary, which comes to be called Satan, and there were angels. And there is, I won't call it a relationship, but there is something that the Old Testament teaches about all of these and humans. First of all, the demonic world, the world of demons, was simply assumed, as I said, as a reality. But for the people of God, contact with that part of creation or existence was strictly forbidden. You see it in passages such as Exodus 22:18, Leviticus 19:31, Leviticus 20:27, Deuteronomy 18:9-13, and 1 Samuel 28:9, and other places as well. This means that the worship of demonic powers, associating oneself with witchcraft, divination, and fortune-telling, all of these were forbidden to the people of God. The forbidding them from doing that freed Israel from the fear and bondage to these spirits that gripped the other peoples. And so because of Israel's commitment to God and his provision for them, they were free of subjection to these other things. And There's a very interesting statement to me that God makes with regard to the Israelites, and in particular to Abraham. He who harms you harms me. He who curses you actually curses me. And he who blesses you blesses me. And so a person who would curse the believer, or in the Old Testament, the Israelite, was in effect cursing God. And God would deal with that person. The person who blessed the Israelite or a believer, likewise is blessing God and receives an award accordingly. And this goes directly to something Jesus said in the New Testament, that a person who gives a cup of cold water to a prophet in the name of a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. The idea is that when you bless that which is of God, then you will be blessed. But curse it, and the curse will come back on you. Not on the one you're cursing, but the curse will come back on you. And so this was the thing with the Israelites. They were to have nothing to do with these powers of darkness, as they're sometimes called. But they were to remain free of these things, and God would bless them and God would provide for them. Satan, who is talked about in Job chapters 1 and 2, also in 1 Corinthians 21:1 and Zechariah 3:1, actually the word means adversary, and was, according to Isaiah chapter 14 verses 12 to 19, he was originally a cherub of great power and authority in heaven. He was the light bearer. He was next to God until pride entered his heart, and with pride came the fall. It's not originally a proper name, but gradually it came to be a proper name over a period of time and through the usage of the term as the Old Testament world and the rabbis and so on developed their understanding. The function is thought to be an adversary to humans to accuse them before God. And I know we have all kinds of ideas that circulate out there about Satan and what Satan does, and you know, there's the devil made me do it thing, and there's different ways in which Christians say, well, Satan is trying to do this or do this or do this, or trip me up here, trip me up there. Actually, at least in the Old Testament, Satan is the accuser of the people. Satan stands before God and he says, you know, God, you can't do this with Abraham. I mean, look at what Abraham did. He was a liar. He was a cheat. God, you can't do this with David now. Look, David, look at what David did. He was a murderer. He was an adulterer. He disobeyed you. And so on like that. He is the accuser of people before God. People fail on their own. Now, maybe the New Testament has a slightly different concept, but in the Old Testament, people fail to measure up to being righteous and holy and perfect and so forth like that on their own. Satan is the one who stands before God accusing them of being less than God, of not being righteous, of not being holy, and so forth like that. And this is the picture that the Old Testament paints of the role of Satan. So it's that of the adversary, the one who stands against a person, the one who accuses the person before God. Angels is the last one. I want to finish with this before we break. Angels have a limited role in the Old Testament. In fact, you only see angels a few times. And it's mostly in the early portions of the Old Testament, but you do see angels in other places as well. Angels are basically connected with God in the heavenly sphere. They are kind of like court messengers. They are organized in a structured pattern with the archangels and the angels and these sorts of things. They are mediators, and especially they are defenders of humans. And in the Old Testament, angels are especially defenders of Israel. As I said, the highest angels are the archangels, and you have two in the Old Testament who are named, Michael and Gabriel, who are the guardians of Israel. That means that's the group they focus on. Now, outside the Old Testament, there are other angels and archangels who are named. But within the Old Testament, only two are named, and that's Michael and Gabriel. And during the period between the Old and the New Testament, you get a lot more focus on what is called angelology. And so there you get more angels, more names of angels, and so on, that emerge. But in the Old Testament itself, the angels are simply messengers and guardians from the heavenly court.